From the Sky News Centre at 6. In the last hour, it's been confirmed check-in staff, baggage handlers and cargo crew will go on strike at 18 airports just before Christmas. More than 1,500 members of the Unite Union will walk out for 48 hours from next Friday in a row over pay. They've rejected a new deal which they claim barely keeps pace with inflation. General Secretary of the Unite Union, Len McCluskey, says they never take these decisions lightly.
Whenever you're engaged in a service industry and it gets to the stage of industrial action, innocent members of the public suffer. That's why we do everything in our power to persuade companies to arrive at reasonable agreements.
Around 600 inmates are thought to be involved in a riot at HMP Birmingham. The disturbance reportedly started at around 9 o'clock this morning and has led to prisoners burning their records and smashing light fittings. The Ministry of Justice says there's no risk to the public. A woman abused by a paedophile who's now 101 years old says he deserves to rot in hell for what he's done. Ralph Clark from Birmingham is thought to be Britain's oldest ever prisoner. He's expected to be sentenced next week after being convicted of 30 sexual offences committed in the 1970s and early 80s. This victim says knowing he'll be jailed is the most amazing feeling in the world.
It was that first guilty that was the important one. That first one meant we were believed. We'll never get full closure. But it was a huge step towards some closure.
The UN's Secretary General has urged Syria to resume the evacuation of people from Aleppo after the operation was suspended. Ban Ki-moon said the city is now a synonym for hell in his final press conference before he steps down at the end of the month. A Chinese warship has seized a US Navy underwater drone collecting unclassified data in the South China Sea. The Pentagon says the United States has issued a formal diplomatic complaint. And an outbreak of bird flu has been confirmed in Turkey. It's at a farm near Louth in Lincolnshire. More than 5,000 birds have been affected. That's the latest. I'm Emma Jones.
This is your double Sony Gold Award winning BCFM radio.
You better know my name.
Come on. 93.2 FM.
Money is being consolidated in fewer and fewer hands as never before in the history of the world. Without reform, the middle class will soon be extinct, leaving only the very rich few and the very many poor, as has already occurred in most of the world.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Donald Trump's latest disastrous picks for his cabinet to be inaugurated in January. And Aleppo, is it a synonym for hell? Or should we be celebrating as the city is liberated from terrorists? Also, the alleged founder of the Brussels bombings just gone to jail, but it turns out he was working for MI5 all along, but thanks to a crooked judge, the jury weren't even allowed to know. France renews its state of emergency for the fifth time since the Paris attacks in November 2015. That means it'll cover all the way through April's presidential elections there. And Russia not only hacked Hillary Clinton and her chief of staff's emails, but hacked the US presidential election too. Is there any evidence for this, or is it just a ginormous lie? More fake news by the London media. On the contrary, five of Russia's largest banks were targeted by a mystery hacker. Or is it some kid in their bedroom, or the NSA Edward Snowden warned us about? Also, the NSA, along with their own GCHQ in Cheltenham, have been hacking into mobile phones on flights, particularly those in Air France. Le Monde is going crazy about it this week. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, Indigenous people in Colombia say they're not going to be bullied by the UN's so-called equalities agenda. Also, we hear more from the English Civil War Museum up in Newark. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. You can listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, Martin, I thought we'd start with something sort of spinning off what we just heard from the news again there, which was that Ban Ki-moon, Secretary-General of the UN, saying that Aleppo is a synonym for hell. He'll be very soon stepping down. Taking over from him is former Portuguese Prime Minister António Guterres. Oh, I suppose we'll be hearing quite a lot about him in the next few years.
Well, indeed, but I presume what we're talking about is not the UN, but Aleppo. I mean, the barrage of propaganda about this has reached hysterical proportions, it seems to me. The Syrian Arab army, with their allies, are basically retaking the fraction of Aleppo that was held by the rebels. Majority of the citizens of Aleppo are in government-controlled areas. If you look at RT, Russia Today, you will see people celebrating the fact that they've been liberated from the control of the rebels. But in the Western media, we're being told that by people like Peter Tatchell that eastern Aleppo is another Guernica, another Srebrenica.
Okay, so can you make those comparisons, Srebrenica and Guernica? How do they compare to what's happened in Aleppo?
Completely different. I mean, of course, every situation is unique. That's one of the things about it.
But what happened in Srebrenica? What happened
in
Guernica?
Well, in Guernica, you had one of the first unprovoked air attacks.
This is in the 1930s.
On a civilian population, yeah. By the German at the Luftwaffe working for General Franco, and they made no attempt to distinguish between civilian and military targets. They just flattened the town, which was regarded as a horrific thing at the time, although of course when the RAF did the same thing to Dresden on a much bigger scale some years later, it wasn't regarded as such a horrific thing. Srebrenica was a situation in which a Muslim enclave within what was Republika Srpska, completely surrounded by Serbian-controlled territory. It was supposedly a UN safe zone, and the Serbs went in and basically rounded up all the military-age males and murdered them. But, of course, the Bosnian army had been using the UN safe zone as a base for their operations against the Serbs. I'm not saying that justifies what the Serbs did. I'm just saying that that's what that was about. What we've had in eastern Aleppo is largely terrorists from outside of Syria have infiltrated Aleppo because it's near the Turkish border. They've been supplied by NATO powers and by the Gulf Cooperation Council powers with all sorts of weaponry, which have allowed them to continue to operate for 4 years. But they've, you know, basically they've now lost that foothold.
Now, as part of that, sort of contested in the media, really, isn't it? Some parts of the world saying this is happening, some parts that. And a Canadian journalist called Eva Bartlett was confronted by people working for one specific guy working for the Western media about her views on this particular subject, and this is what she had to say in reply. So we'll start off, this is a couple of minutes, but it starts off with his questions and then we've got her reply.
When you talk about the Syrian people and what the Syrian people want, how can you quantify that? Do you have any independent surveys where you can actually document that? And secondly, you talk about the corporate media, the Western media, the lies, and all of this. Could you explain what you think might be the agenda from us in the Western media? And why we should lie, why the international organizations on the ground should lie, why we shouldn't believe all these absolutely documentable facts that we see from the ground, these hospitals being bombed, these civilians who are talking about the atrocities that they have been experiencing. How can you justify calling all of us liars?
Sure.
Thank you.
I mean, there are certainly honest journalists amongst the very compromised establishment media. Let's start with your second question. So, international organizations on the ground. Tell me which ones are on the ground in eastern Aleppo. Yeah, okay, I'll tell you. There are none. These organizations are relying on the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is based in Coventry, UK, and which is one man. They're relying on compromised groups like the White Helmets, which let's talk about the White Helmets. The White Helmets were founded in 2013 by a British ex-military officer. They have been funded to the tune of $100 million by the US, UK, and Europe and other states. They purport to be rescuing civilians in eastern Aleppo and Idlib, yet no one in eastern Aleppo has heard of them. And I say no one, bearing in mind that now 95% of these areas of eastern Aleppo are liberated. The White Helmets purport to be neutral, yet they can be found carrying guns and standing in the dead bodies of Syrian soldiers. And their video footage actually contains children that have been recycled in different reports. So you can find a girl named Aya who turns up in a report in month, say, August, and she turns up in the next month in two different locations. So they are not credible. The SOHR is not credible. Unnamed activists are not credible. Once or twice, maybe, but every time, not credible. So your sources on the ground, you don't have them. As for your agenda, not your, but the agenda of some corporate media, it is the agenda of regime change. How can the New York Times, I was reading it this morning, or how can Democracy Now!, which I was reading the other day, maintain until this day that this is a civil war in Syria? How can they maintain until this day that there were that the protests were unarmed and nonviolent until, say, 2012? That is absolutely not true. How can they maintain that the Syrian government is attacking civilians in Aleppo when every person that's coming out of these areas occupied by terrorists is saying the opposite? How do I quantify the support of the Syrian people? The elections. In 2014, the Syrian people held elections. The point being, overwhelmingly, the people support President Assad. There are people that want change in the government. We're not pretending they don't want change. Everybody wants change. But in terms of support of the government, the point is they don't see President Assad as the problem. They see the problem as terrorism. They see elements of problems in the system that they have there. But President Assad, they don't see as the problem. They actually overwhelmingly support him. So I'm basing it on their choice in their leader, and I'm basing it on my interactions with people in Syria.
Well, I think that's a pretty good summary of what's gone wrong with the Western media's reporting on what's been going on in Syria. And what's extraordinary to me is that they've locked themselves, that their past lies are trapping them in further lies. And I think that the White Helmets are a very important organisation to focus on. So they've received $150 million from the US taxpayer, set up by a British military officer called James Le Mesurier, based in Turkey, and then they present what are basically doctored videos, which are then presented to us as independent proof. Look,
okay, the point
of
being, Martin. Okay, can we just get on
supposedly
to the point?
Been committed?
Let's get on the point, which is maybe that. Clearly, the point is that there are apparently tens of thousands of civilians that have been caught up with these, whether you want to call them rebels or terrorists, that are being killed by the Syrian Arab Army and the Russians.
I think all fighting in urban areas is incredibly messy. Ask the US Marines that stormed into Fallujah in 2003, where thousands of civilians ended up dead, because fighting in urban areas is like that. And of course, the terrorists.
Well, so the Western media is right then, actually, isn't it?
No. The Syrian Arab Army has taken 4 years to liquidate the terrorist pocket in Aleppo because they've taken their time to try and avoid just squashing the whole situation as the US Marines did in Fallujah. I mean, we were talking about what does Eastern Aleppo compare with? It compares with Fallujah. It compares with Mosul. It compares with various cities in Iraq which have been devastated by our own forces. When we were trying to crush the Sunni resistance in Fallujah, we didn't really care too much about civilian casualties. These kind of wars are messy. And of course, the war in Syria was started by Western powers.
Okay, the good news, is that there's actually an evacuation going on right now. Actually, the evacuation apparently has been suspended today as Al-Qaeda-linked rebels, according to The Guardian, block the deal. Rebel sources are suggesting Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, this is the Sham Liberation Front, the al-Nusra effectively, will allow the wounded to leave pro-government villages, which could restart the Aleppo evacuation, maybe.
Yeah, because what the Syrians are saying is we've got our people surrounded in Deir ez-Zor, which is surrounded by ISIS. The RAF participated in killing 80 Syrian soldiers who were protecting that enclave from attack by ISIS. If I can just take this opportunity, Tony, to mention Roland Dumas one more time, because you sent me an email about this. I did check it. Roland Dumas did not, who actually said that he was approached by British officials before the war in Syria broke out and said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria.
Yes, I think it's one of our listeners put you straight on
this. One of our listeners has put us straight on that.
Put you straight,
I've always assumed, because of the timing, that he must have been working for the Sarkozy government. He wasn't.
He was a former
foreign minister who used to be a foreign minister under François Mitterrand.
One thing
Mitterrand.
I'm sure they taught you at Oxford, never assume anything.
Indeed, and I'm very glad to the person concerned who's drawn my attention to it.
So he was
I don't think
Mitterrand.
It makes any substantial difference to his allegation. But of course it would be more of the horse's mouth if he had been Sarkozy's foreign minister. The point is that as the Canadian journalist just pointed out, the peaceful, so-called peaceful demonstrations that began the whole crisis weren't peaceful from the get-go. What was happening is that people were having a peaceful demonstration, then people in that demonstration started shooting police and demonstrators.
Look,
which is what we saw also in the Maidan Square.
Can we look at the situation as it is at the moment? Because a lot of these rebel fighters, terrorists, whatever you want to call them, are now being shipped north into northern Syria, and they are not going home anytime soon, because many of them, as you said, are not from Syria. And also you've got problems with the Turks. Erdogan is now occupying parts of northern Syria. Is he going to go home? Because it looks as if there's much more work to do to actually get Syria back to its original borders. It may never get there,
possibly because there's going to be an independent Kurdish state inside Turkey. And of course we've not mentioned Diyarbakir, which has been under siege by the Turkish army, who are part of NATO, and hundreds of civilians have been killed, but we haven't heard anything about that. No Peter Tatchell screaming we've got to go to war against our NATO ally Turkey. But of course, and all these people saying that we should do something in Syria. Well, what do you want to do? You want to fight Russia in Syria? Because that's what we're talking about.
With the United Nations at the moment, we've got some severe problems with the UN. One does wonder if having a new Secretary General is going to actually make much difference. This former Portuguese Prime Minister attended the Bilderberg Conference in 1994. As we know, the Bilderberg wield this magic wand of power, so it may be that they're one of the groups that have decided he's the right guy for the job, having interviewed him back in the 1990s. But you've got some real serious problems, haven't you? The Justice Committee, I think I've got this the right way around, being chaired by the Israelis, and the Human Rights Committee being chaired by Saudi Arabia at the UN.
Indeed. Well, Kofi Annan tried to broker a deal, as did Brahimi from Algeria, I think, when Kofi Annan was UN head of the UN. The Western powers have stitched up the UN bureaucracy to be their mouthpieces, and they're not really independent anymore. And of course what we're actually getting in international politics is, you know, two big camps developing: the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and NATO, effectively. And they don't agree about anything because they're basically at war with each other.
Also talk this week of possibly trying to take the World Cup off of Russia. FIFA, some murmurings at FIFA that maybe Russia is not an appropriate place to be having the World Cup.
Well, I mean, everything is being...
It's 2018, it's
well,
not
I mean,
next
you
year,
saw what happened in the Olympic Games and the Paralympics, where the Russian team were banned and so on. I mean, basically nothing the Russians do is right, as far as some people are concerned, which is... Well, we're going to come on to this later in the show, all this huffing and puffing about they're supposedly stealing the US elections. I mean, this is potential. People shouldn't be complacent about this. This kind of talk could lead to World War III. If the RAF, for example, gets shot down over Syria, attacking the Syrian army, World War III will start.
Okay, so there's growing calls last weekend for Russia to be banned from the Winter Olympics and other major international events after the latest revelations of state-sponsored doping across Russian sport. Okay. Richard McLaren described on Friday how Russia hijacked sport by involving more than 1,000 athletes in an institutional conspiracy to win by mass doping at the Sochi 2014 Winter and London 2012 Olympics and other global competitions. The Canadian lawyer, who detailed in a previous report how Russian security services were involved in the nefarious scheme, said in a second report for the World Anti-Doping Agency At least 30 sports were implicated. Salt and instant coffee were used to manipulate Russian samples. Russia's sports ministry was said to be central to the ruse to cheat its way to success over several years.
Right, so they cheat at sports by doping. They don't have complete positive attitudes to homosexuality.
The Russian track and field team.
They kill children.
Martin, the Russian track and field team were banned from international competition for doping, weren't they? Are you denying that?
No, but the point is that all of these so-called independent international organisations are being manipulated by Western intelligence services in order to create an enemy. They need an enemy in order to carry on the spending money in places like Filton to keep people in jobs, because we don't produce anything that anybody wants anymore. We only produce weapons. And if we're going to carry on producing weapons, we've got to have somebody to pretend to fight, and that would be the Russians. But the problem about pretending to fight people is you can end up fighting them.
Former Moscow doping laboratory director Grigory Roshenkov swapped positive urine samples with previously collected clean samples, adding salt and coffee to replicate the consistency of the original.
Who says that?
This is this report from this Canadian lawyer I mentioned a moment ago, Richard McLaren.
Well, it may or may not be true, but if the people think that no doping goes on in Western countries, they're living in cloud cuckoo land. Lance Price just pops into my mind as an American who was convicted of doping. Should the whole American team be banned from sports on
that
basis?
Well, there was that cyclist, wasn't there? I mean, we were reporting on this a couple of months ago, who was saying that he was tried to report a doctor who was actually encouraging him to take illegal substances and had been doing it and was boasting to him of doing it for people in all sorts of sports. And when he tried to report it, he was just told to go away, effectively. There was no kind of... whoever our anti-doping agency are weren't interested.
Well, indeed. It strikes me that what seems to be happening, and I'm not really an expert on doping in sport, is that anything that can be used to beat the Russians with is being used to beat them with. And that's certainly how it's perceived by Russian public opinion, which is why President Putin has an 80% approval rating, which is about twice the approval rating for Theresa May.
And how exactly has Russia's role in Syria and Aleppo been? It's been pretty crucial, hasn't it?
Well, what they've done is they've supported the legitimate government of Syria, which did win a democratic election. I can remember years ago, one of the Western reporters who was reporting from Aleppo talking to a rebel, and the rebel ruefully admitting to him that the problem we've got is we don't have a lot of popular support around here. And NATO had an internal document which was leaked, which showed that up to 70% of the Syrian population supported the regime. That was their internal assessment.
Well, this word regime is what's used on the BBC all the time, but actually it's a legitimate elected government.
Yes, it is.
You're so caught up in the propaganda, you're using it yourself.
I'm using it in inverted commas.
Well, we don't talk about Theresa May's regime, do we?
No, we don't, do we? Perhaps we ought to, because Assad's clearly got more support in Syria than she's got in Britain.
Well, certainly there is this big question over 30 Conservative MPs where evidence has been submitted to the Electoral Commission showing that they overspent and then they fraudulently submitted accounts for those various constituencies. And yet at the moment, the Conservatives have only got a majority of 10. So if those 30 MPs who overspent on their election had to rerun in by-elections, the Conservatives wouldn't have a majority anymore, probably.
No,
well,
I think what's happened in Syria is that Bashar al-Assad, who, remember, when he first came to power, was regarded by the West as a moderniser and a sensible chap, because he lived in England and was an optician and not at all a thuggish type. And he's actually grown into the role of being president. He only became president because his brother died in a car accident, and he was then pushed into the role. But in actual fact, with all the fighting and killing that's gone on, he has got the stature now of a Syrian Abraham Lincoln, who is determined to keep his country together and to crush terrorist rebellion. And the terrorists themselves are al-Qaeda, who we've supposedly been fighting for 15 years and invaded a whole string of countries to crush them. And here we've got the White Helmets, funded by us, embedded with al-Qaeda, telling us how wonderful the rebels are.
Anyway, The Guardian was reporting tonight that the evacuation of Aleppo is ground to a halt because the al-Nusra terrorists are refusing to allow an evacuation of a equivalent part of the Aleppo area, where there is a government, where basically they to allow people out of a government-held area.
Yeah. In an equivalent way. We're all focused on eastern Aleppo, but of course there are all sorts of pockets all over the Syrian battlefield. Where, I mean, Deir ez-Zor, I mentioned earlier, which is completely surrounded by ISIS. The RAF participated in that so-called accidental attack on the Syrian military army positions there, killing 80 Syrian soldiers. And I looked at the religious affiliations of those 80 Syrian soldiers, and it was a cross-section of the Syrian population. And the Assad regime is actually supported by a cross-section of all communities. The rebels are supported by Saudi Arabia and us.
As is the Assad government. Anyway, so let's have a listen to Prime Minister's questions where Aleppo came up, of course.
Lucy Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The heartbreaking humanitarian crisis and genocide in Syria continues to take place as the world watches on impotently. Yet there is still no end in sight. Does the Prime Minister agree with the Right Honourable Member for Tatton that what is happening in Syria is a failure of Western leadership? And does she agree with me that what is now urgently required is what our dear friend Joe Cox called for nearly a year ago, and that is a UK-led strategy to protect civilians, whether it's those fleeing persecution, whether it is those surrendering themselves, or those that are still besieged?
We must all take responsibility for decisions that we have taken, whether we take those decisions sitting around the National Security Council table, or indeed this House in taking a decision that it did in 2013. The Honourable Lady raises the question.
3 years ago.
The Honourable Lady raises the question of a UK-led action in relation to the protection of civilians. It is the UK that has been pressing for action inside the United Nations Security Council, working with the French. The two most recent emergency UN Security Council meetings were those that we called for. The most recent of those took place yesterday. As I'm sure the Honourable Lady will know, there have been 6 UN Security Council resolutions which have been vetoed by Russia. The most recent also vetoed by China. We are continuing to work with the United Nations, but if we're to get a solution that works on the ground, then it has to be a solution that is actually bought into by other countries, and it has to be a solution that Russia is going to buy into as well as the regime.
Well, I'm glad to hear that she realised that Russia and the regime, i.e. Assad regime, have got to buy into any solution, because that's been clear from the get-go. The fact of the matter is, we mentioned Roland Dumas earlier, he wasn't working for Sarkozy, he was a former French foreign minister, but he put on the record that he was approached by British officials before the Arab Spring, who said that we are going to start an arms uprising.
Yes, and your party, Lucy Powell there, Central Manchester MP, is absolutely disgusted by the way the civilians have been being treated right now in Aleppo.
Civilians in western Aleppo have been under constant random bombardment by the terrorists which we've supplied with weapons. I just don't get this. It's absolutely this liberal hand-wringing about eastern Aleppo. What about all the other places around Syria where all these civilians have been murdered by our terrorists that we've armed and trained? The SAS even show them how to shoot people, and then they go and shoot people. If I was the Syrian government, I might decide to come back to Britain after the RAF, for example, had killed 80 of their soldiers, and we might have to just kill some RAF personnel to get the message through to people. You kill us, we kill you. That's warfare.
Well, it can be, and it should be on some occasions. But I mean, you surely must have some sympathy for those people, civilians, who are just kind of caught up in this dreadful situation.
Absolutely. And there's a British vicar, Reverend Andrew somebody or other, who's actually on the ground in Aleppo, and he wrote a very good piece this week saying, it horrifies me to see the fighting, but ultimately the only way to end this war is for the good guys to win. That's how wars sometimes end, especially when the Western powers don't want to let go of this bone. They're being defeated, but they're not going to accept it. They're still coming out with this Assad must go, and because Trump's got a more nuanced position on this, they're trying to create further trouble in Syria so that
British,
he can't do what he wants to do.
Is the British Foreign Office being isolated and Downing Street being isolated now if Trump is going to kind of say, well, I'm not
well, it may well
Syria.
Be the case, but because Trump doesn't come in till next month, all of this stuff is being pushed. I mean, what they should do is just give up trying to overthrow Assad. They're not prepared to give up on that. And of course, if Trump wants to give up on that, they're going to try and make it impossible for him, because Obama just lifted the so-called ban on providing advanced weaponry to the rebels. In fact, they've been supplying them under the table anyway. The Saudis have given everything they wanted from us in the first place. And they're trying to drag the war out. And you even read some of the stuff from the Brookings Institute and say, we can't let this war end. We can't let it end because Assad would win and then we would look weak. And that's what this is about, macho posturing.
Well, you mentioned Saudi Arabia there. It was also brought up by Angus Robertson from the SNP on Wednesday.
Mr. Angus Robertson.
The US government has just said that, and I quote, systematic endemic problems in Saudi Arabia's targeting drove the US decision to halt a future weapons sale involving precision-guided munitions. The Saudis have UK-supplied precision-guided Paveway 4 missiles. They're made in Scotland. The UK has licensed £3.3 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia since the beginning of the bombing campaign. What will it take for the UK to adopt an ethical foreign policy when it comes to Yemen?
Well, as the Right Honourable Gentleman knows, the intervention in Yemen is a UN-backed intervention. As I've said previously, where there are allegations of breaches of international humanitarian law, then we require those to be properly investigated. We do have a relationship with Saudi Arabia. The security of the Gulf is important to us, and I would simply also remind the Right Honourable Gentleman that actually Saudi intelligence, the counter-terrorism links we have with Saudi Arabia, the intelligence we get from Saudi Arabia has saved potentially hundreds of lives here in the UK.
What a farrago of nonsense from Theresa May there. And all of this liberal wailing about Eastern Aleppo. The same things, much more indiscriminate attacks are being carried out with British weaponry in Yemen. And don't forget, both in Yemen and Bahrain, Saudi Arabia has crossed international borders to carry out these attacks. What's going on in Syria is an internal affair, apart from the foreign terrorists that have been infiltrated by us through Jordan and Turkey. And the hypocrisy stinks to heaven, and the blood of millions is on the hands of successive British governments, and they have the cheek to turn around and accuse others who are trying to defend themselves of being in the wrong. Ultimately, I think what's going on here is we're accusing others of what we ourselves are doing.
Okay, Russia not only apparently hacked Hillary Clinton and her chief of staff's emails, but also hacked the US presidential elections too. Is there any evidence for this, or is this fake news?
Well, if you're asking me, I'd say there's no evidence for it. It's a bit like the doping scandal. It's a bit like stuff in Eastern Aleppo. What we are dealing with is the drumbeat, drum, 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 of warmongering. That's what we're listening to, warmongering people, mongering their wars.
Well, Craig Murray has talked about this, the former ambassador. I spoke to him earlier today, and he said that he's been advised by WikiLeaks he better not say anything much more about it.
Well, that's because he was involved in the actual leak, and it was a leak. It's not a hack. It's a leak. The person who leaked the information about the rigging of the Democratic primaries by the Clinton campaign was a fed-up Bernie Sanders supporter. It wasn't the Russians, and it wasn't a hack.
And so he was leaking it because he could see corruption going on within the Democratic National Convention, the Democrat Party. And so he said, well, look, because it's so corrupt in the Democrat Party, I think that the public needs to see some of this.
Indeed, and Craig Murray actually flew to the US to receive the documents.
I seem to remember...
They weren't transmitted by email at all.
I seem to remember that we actually covered the story where he was blocked at the airport. He was told he wasn't allowed to go to the US, and then he managed to get permission to go. So that may have been when that was all taking place.
Indeed. And this is all part of a manipulation.
Anyway, his piece on his brilliant, superb blog, Craig Murray's blog, is really one of the best in the country, in the world, really. He said he's watched incredulous as the CIA's blatant lie has grown and grown as a media story. Blatant because the CIA has made no attempt whatsoever to substantiate it. There is no Russian involvement in the leaks of emails showing Clinton's corruption. Yes, this rubbish has been in the lead today in the Washington Post in the US, and the Guardian in Britain was also the lead item on the BBC main News, I suspect it is leading the US broadcast news also. A little simple logic demolishes the CIA's claims. They claim they know the individuals involved, yet under Obama, the USA has been absolutely ruthless in its persecution of whistleblowers and its pursuit of foreign hackers through extradition. We're supposed to believe that the most vital instance imaginable, an attempt by a foreign power to destabilise the US election, even though the CIA knows who the individuals are, nobody's going to be arrested. Nobody's going to be extradited, or, if in Russia, made subject to yet more banking and other restrictions against Russian individuals. Plainly, it stinks. The anonymous source claims of we know who it was the Russians, are beneath contempt.
Well, that's right. We're in a post-truth world, and not because of shows like this and the internet. It's because Western governments take taxpayers' money and set up things like the White Helmets, and the CIA has been a big boondoggle for years, and then they come up with all sorts of lies and fibs to bend the minds of the population to try and herd them along like sheep in certain directions. And to call that democracy is stretching the use of language.
Also, of course, it's John Brennan that's the director of the CIA, and Donald Trump has removed him. He's going to be out in January, so it may be that this is a last blast from him.
Well, what's extraordinary is I think what we've got is a fight going on at the top of the intelligence community in the US and in the establishment. And, of course, in Syria, this has extremely important
consequences. Is it fair for the Western media, the whole of the London media, to report a story where the CIA contact them? They say, well, we know it's true, but we can't tell you, and we can't give you any evidence. We can't actually flesh this out. Otherwise, that would compromise national security.
Well, all I can say is, in 2017, as we soon will be in, if they think that they can just huff and puff and say CIA says it's true but we can't tell you and we're to be trusted, I think that the people of the world should be able to see through that straight away. The CIA is an organised lying machine. It always has been. It still is.
Okay,
and therefore, when they say something, you can pretty much guarantee true.
I'll put a link to Craig Murray's article, The CIA's Absence of Conviction, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But one of the people who's spoken out about this just a couple of days ago is President Obama himself.
There is no doubt that when any foreign government tries to impact the integrity of our elections, that we need to take action, and we will, at a time and place of our own choosing. Some of it may be explicit and publicized, some of it may not be. But Mr. Putin is well aware of my feelings about this because I spoke to him directly about it.
Yeah, they've also said that Putin was directly involved in the hack. And of course, they've been threatening to carry out cyber attacks on Russia, and they've been hinting that nasty consequences might happen. Accidents can happen, and then an accident did happen, which you mentioned earlier in the show. Five top Russian banks were attempted to be taken down by a mysterious hacker. Now, who could that be?
This is a story on actually Thursday, the 10th of November last month. Simon Robb for Metro.co.uk. At least five of Russia's largest banks targeted in a massive cyber attack using 24,000 computers, one of the security giants confirmed. Country's largest state-controlled Sberbank said it was targeted but managed to neutralise it. Moscow-based internet security giant Kaspersky said hackers tapped into thousands of devices to target the website of at least five websites of at least five well-known financial institutions. In the top 10, the banks were targeted throughout Thursday, lasting almost 12 hours. A system called DDoS, distributed denial of service, was used to flood bank servers. In the attacks, more than 660,000 requests were sent per second by hijacking more than 24,000 devices in 30 countries. It's believed botnets, also known as the Zombie Army, were used to accomplish this. Botnets are devices like CCTV and digital video recorders are used to forward transmissions without the owner's knowledge. So this came actually around about a week after the Russians warned that the West was planning something like this, and then it actually happened. Incredible.
Although hardly reported at all in the Western media. You'd have thought it would have been top of the news of five Russian banks, somebody's trying to hack them down. So, but reported in Computer News is the only place I found the information.
Well, it was
certainly not the BBC.
It was there in the Metro, and one wonders whether some of the other mainstream medias were deliberately keeping that one out of the spotlight.
Well, indeed,
because
this whole thing raises questions.
This whole thing
it?
Of cyber attacks has been talked about. First, it was talked about by Jens Stoltenberg, who's the NATO Secretary General, then by Hillary Clinton, then by Theresa May, I think it was, over here, saying, well, look, you know, if the Russians do some sort of hack attack, we may have to retaliate with real force.
Yes, or with cyber force. And, of course, we know that the Israelis and the Western powers, including US and Britain, carried out the Stuxnet attack on Iran, which was attempting to try and knock out their nuclear program. And then, of course, the Stuxnet virus escaped and helped to make Fukushima the mess that it still is. And that's not reported, is it?
And on five,
let's not even talk about
on
that.
BBC 5 Live today, they did do a report on this story, which is where I got that Obama clip from. And also they spoke to Sir Andrew Wood, who's a former British ambassador to Moscow, to Russia.
I don't see how Donald Trump could not have known something. I think that's almost impossible. And what he actually said was to Hillary Clinton in the debates, you can't prove it, essentially. Those weren't his words, but he's just saying you don't know. He never said, this is serious, it must be investigated.
I think it's just, there's no evidence whatsoever that Trump was in cahoots with Putin to hack the US election. Don't forget, there are two aspects to this. One is the leaks of the emails which showed Clinton had rigged the Democratic primaries, and that Podesta and others, and also, of course, that they'd been supporting ISIS and so on. That's all. Nobody disputes what was in the emails. And they're saying that it affected the election and that the Russians must have done it. But what's in the emails, as Putin pointed out, is the important part, which is that they were supporting ISIS. They were, that the Saudi Arabia did fund the Clinton campaign and the Clinton Foundation, and that they had rigged the Democratic primary, and she shouldn't really have been the electoral candidate. Now, all of that is just, they don't dispute any of that. They just say, oh, well, the information was secret and shouldn't have been leaked. But it was, as Craig Murray's pointed out, it wasn't hacked. It was a leak. And then, of course, they're now saying that they hacked the actual election itself, which I find a bit strange, because although their electronic voting machines are used in the US, most ballots are actually paper ballots. So how the Russians can hack a paper ballot box, I really don't know. I mean, the level of illogic in these allegations is extraordinary.
Okay, let's just go through what Craig Murray's saying again. He says, I know who leaked them. I've met the person who leaked them, and they are certainly not Russian, and it's an insider. It's a leak, not a hack. The two are different things. If what the CIA is saying is true, and the CIA's statement refers to people who are known to be linked to the Russian state, then they would have arrested someone. If it was someone inside the United States, America has not been shy about arresting whistleblowers, and it's not been shy about extraditing hackers. They plainly have no knowledge whatsoever. So the whole thing, it seems, maybe a bit of a sort of just a massive lie.
It's
anyway,
just propaganda.
On this BBC 5 Live programme this morning, Emma Barnett's show, she also interviewed a chap called Edward Lucas, who I'd not come across before. Very interesting character. He's one of the editors of The Economist magazine, and he had this to say about Russian money laundering.
The dirty money that flows in such vast quantities out of Russia and into the financial system in both Britain and America and other countries. And this is really the biggest vulnerability that the Kremlin's got, that they stash their cash in the Western financial system while preaching anti-Westernism as a sort of political ideology. And they already have taken some steps under what are called the Magnitsky sanctions, which is relating to a lawyer who died after being very badly treated in Moscow after he'd revealed a huge government money laundering scam. And so we have precedent to do this. Those went through Congress and were actually resisted by the administration. But there's plenty more that could be done about all sorts of financial misbehaviour that the Russians...
Well, it's just more tittle-tattle, isn't it? Magnitsky and Khodorkovsky, for example, who was a great hero in the West. Khodorkovsky was a criminal, as many oligarchs in Russia are, as many oligarchs in this country are. And of course, what they're doing is that the image of Russia in the Yeltsin era, when I used to visit, is being used to blacken the modern Russian state as if it was still the shambles when the IMF were fully in charge of Russia. The IMF are no longer fully in charge of Russia, which is why they're now being accused of being oligarchical thieves, whereas when the oligarchy were thieving, they weren't accused of any of this because their oligarchy were thieving on our behalf.
Anyway, the Economist editor, Edward Lucas, he says that the Russians actually are definitely involved in this interfering in the elections.
Well, how does he know?
It's no secret that the intelligence agencies all over Europe have been worried about Russia for years, and they've found difficulty in getting their political masters to take it seriously.
But when it's interfered with an election like this...
It's happened in other countries before that Russia's interfered in elections, but we've, as I said, it's been very difficult to get the big Western intelligence agencies a real hearing at the top from politicians, that, you know, whether it's Tony Blair or Gordon Brown or David Cameron, the Obama administration, Angela Merkel, lots of the big Western governments have just been unwilling to listen to what their spies were telling them about the extent of Russian mischief-making, meddling and interference all over the place. It's not just in elections, it's also the use of organised crime, sort of, in propaganda. I think that there's still large chunks of the world that doesn't understand that this is a problem, but I think in Europe, certainly the Germans are now waking up very alertly to this, and they've got elections coming, and they think that the same tactics that were used against Hillary Clinton are going to be used against Angela Merkel.
Right.
And they're really worried about that. So I think that, certainly I sense that our own government is taking this a lot more seriously than they did, but I'm afraid it's still too little and too late, as far as I'm concerned.
So why is Edward Lucas saying the same tactics which were used against Hillary Clinton will be used against Angela Merkel, where it looks as if actually what's happened is that they've just made it up, the CIA?
Yeah, they have just made it up, and all these people are an echo chamber. You don't get to be editor of The Economist by treading on toes in the intelligence community. In fact, you get invited to Bilderberg with them, where you cook up your lies about what the Russians are or are not.
Well, it's true. The Economist,
and of course, there's overwhelming evidence that the Western
Martin, the Economists do go to the Bilderberg meetings. Yes, they do go to the Bilderberg meetings, but they don't actually report on them. They're there effectively to just simply keep an eye on what's going on, so they know what's going on. They're also participating. The Economist, who actually owns it and runs it, it's a funny kind of magazine, and one of the things, it's nice to get hold of an editor, because they don't actually have bylines in The Economist, do they?
No, they don't, and that's one of the things that annoys me about it as a magazine, because they present what they're saying as if it's some kind of authoritative truth about the way the economy works, but there's no byline of who's written it, and they haven't explained how they came by the information that they're presenting. But of course, the whole point of The Economist is to present this kind of scholarly, semi-scholarly
there's a very good reason why
on,
there's a very good,
basically propagandistic.
There's a very good reason why you should have a byline, and that is because if you get something wrong, like you did with Roland Dumas, it's very easy to then get hold of the journalist, and or maybe, for example, you may have some very important information to add, say, for example, if it's about the child abuse scandal. Mm. So this is why all journalists need to have a byline, but they're not allowed one at The Economist.
No, well, The Economist is very much part of the establishment. And you know what seems pretty obvious to me is that all the things that the Russians are accused of doing, interfering in elections, oligarchic rip-offs, doping in sport, terrorism, that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing. And, of course, what we're doing is then accusing them of doing what we're doing.
You mean what our criminal elite are doing. But anyhow, look, he also, Edward Lucas, talked about Putin's hand being directly involved in this hacking, supposed hacking, of the US elections.
If the FBI had gone in and arrested people in the Trump campaign for being on the Russian payroll, or if the CIA had said, we've got very strong intelligence evidence that Putin is trying to, but you know, personally trying to get revenge on Hillary Clinton to get Trump elected, then they would have been, people have said, well, why are you interfering in the election campaign? So I think it's very difficult. Intelligence officers don't like being in the political spotlight, and they don't like giving away the sources of what they find out, because that tends to mean you won't be able to find it out again in future. So I think there's a real dilemma for the CIA about how public to be and what to say when. And now they have come out with it, and President Obama has just over 30 days to do whatever it is that he's going to do in the time remaining.
Well, interestingly enough, the FBI have just said it's a load of nonsense, and they're the ones who actually look into these things, supposedly. I don't believe a word any of these people say. But, of course, what is the purpose of all of this, we could ask ourselves. Trump has talked in a more sensible tone of voice about building relationships with Russia. So even if he gets elected on Monday, and he might not be, they will try and box him in so that he can't walk away from a war with Russia, which is what they want.
Also, Edward Lucas talked about the possibility of impeaching Donald Trump.
The president is pretty well entrenched in the American system, and with the Republican Congress, it would be quite hard to see him being impeached, which is the sort of... That was what did for President Nixon, was the prospect of impeachment. We just don't know what the Trump administration is going to be like, and it may be very chaotic. It's already... the popularity ratings aren't great at the moment. It may be mired in unpopularity. It may be very difficult for him to get his things through Congress.
This is about, actually, whether he should be there electorally, if there was an issue with how he got there. And is there an issue with how he has been elected to office?
Well, I think there is very much an issue. I mean, it looks to me... I think that the evidence that we've had put forward shows that Russia was... keep putting a thumb on the scales. Whether that was the decisive factor, we don't know, because Hillary was a terrible candidate and fought a terrible campaign. So there's plenty of other factors as well. And it's theoretically possible that the Electoral College will say, we can't make this man president, and that, you know, that is one of the checks and balances of the Constitution, that it's, you know, not elected by the popular vote, that there is one further sort of hurdle, which is the Electoral College has to say, go ahead and do this. I think that's pretty unlikely myself. But I think it certainly casts a big cloud over his presidency, and particularly the fact that he's gone to war with the intelligence agencies. And if you publicly dismiss the CIA as a bunch of idiots, they are, and you don't, you know, he's not receiving his intelligence briefings, he's not taking any notice of what they're telling him, and I think he's cruising for a bruising on that one, because first of all, you know, he actually needs the intelligence in order to function properly as president, and secondly, if he's really unpleasant to them, they have all sorts of ways of making life difficult for him, not least in leaking things.
Well, I'm reminded of John F. Kennedy's favourite quote, which is, "I intend to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces. He didn't last much longer. The CIA are like a vampire squid on the face of humanity.
That's Goldman Sachs, surely.
Yes, well, I think there's not much difference between the two these days, is there? It's like a revolving door. How does the editor of The Economist know what the CIA knows and thinks? That's because he's got chums in the CIA, and of course they're all chums together,
aren't they?
It sounds
to me as if maybe the London establishment is getting a bit rattled about Donald Trump.
They are. I think that, as I said earlier, I think what the purpose of all of this is they don't. I don't think they are. On Monday, they are not going to. The Electoral College is not going to not make him president. But they're making it difficult for him to make peace with Russia. They're trying to tie his hands so that he's got to stick with the war with Russia line, which is bipartisan in the US and in Britain. Absolutely bonkers. There are serious people in Britain like Michael Heseltine who know it's bonkers.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now we're getting on to a more domestic issue. Convicted terrorist says MI5 pumped and dumped him. This is in The Guardian yesterday. A Birmingham man gave cash to the man in the hat. The Brussels bombing suspect claims he was recruited by MI5 and then thrown to the wolves. Zakaria Boufassil, 26, said he held several meetings with British intelligence agencies personnel who paid him £3,000 for information and brought him gifts, including Camel cigarettes, a Samsung mobile phone, and clothes. I don't know if I would take a Samsung mobile phone or any other mobile phone from MI5. Not that they need to give you one. I'm sure they can get into your phone as it is. Boufassil and Mohammed Ali Ahmed, 27, also of Birmingham, were jailed on Monday this week for handing over £3,000 to Mohammed Abrini at a meeting in Small Heath Park, Birmingham. Abrini earned his nickname Man in the Hat after being spotted on CCTV at Brussels. Well, I wonder if the £3,000 that was handed over was actually the cash from MI5.
Well, quite possibly, although it was also suggested that he defrauded Social Security to get the money. But I think the fact of the matter is that people have got to realise that this guy was working for MI5. Now, that suggests that MI5, just like other intelligence agencies, might have a hand in the Brussels attacks, just as they had a hand in the other attacks that we know have taken place. In other words, when you look closely at this stuff with a proper magnifying glass, it's all rather different from the shouting from the top of the roof.
So why did the judge rule that none of this could be talked about at his case? Because if the jury had known about it, maybe they wouldn't have even convicted him.
Well, like the other chap that was supposedly, well, the Westminster police took him to the Old Bailey, said he was going to join a terrorist organisation in Syria, and then his lawyers were able to...
So what's our advice for anyone out there that gets approached by MI5 to do something like this, potentially to maybe infiltrate or just to give information to them, where even if they are... do come bearing gifts, and of course many of us out there don't have a lot of money, we're very tempted to take that money, aren't we?
Well, you'd be a fool if you did, because they're not going to protect you. You are just going to be used in order to create an image of that they want to happen, and then you'll either be dead or you'll end up in prison.
It's almost like a kind of recruiting agency for the stage magazine for the next production.
Yeah, that's right.
Also, France this week prolonged its state of emergency despite concerns over human rights from Amnesty International. Three times a day at breakfast, lunch and dinner time, Antho Balamba reports at his local police station in a Paris suburb he can't leave his house at night or France at all. He's been placed after house arrest 4 days after the November 2015 Paris bombing and shooting attacks as part of a nationwide state of emergency. He says otherwise he'll go to jail, even though they don't have any apparently any kind of charges against him. This has been happening for weeks and weeks, and it can only carry on because there's a state of emergency in France. The other thing is, this is going to cover all the period up to and after the presidential elections next year.
Indeed, and the purpose of these terrorist attacks, which I believe are being orchestrated within the intelligence services, like the DGSE in France, who set up the Safari Club in the 1980s, which took over the CIA's nefarious role in setting up an international Islamic brigade to fight in Afghanistan.
Well, we talked last week, didn't we, about this whole idea of Gladio C, that actually many of these terrorist attacks in Europe could now be being orchestrated by NATO and by intelligence agencies in the NATO countries. Now, it looks from this story we just had there that the intelligence agencies certainly are very much involved with these terrorist groups. Now, what they'll say is, oh, we're just infiltrating these groups. At which point does that stop, and at which point do the intelligence agencies start to control those groups?
Well, as I mentioned last week, in the US, virtually everybody who's been convicted of terrorism has been set up by the FBI. Now, you would have thought that if you had a serious terrorist attack threat on, you wouldn't waste time setting up patsies.
Donald Trump is to nominate a friend of the settlement movement as the new US ambassador to Israel. President-elect Donald Trump named David Friedman, a bankruptcy lawyer aligned with the Israeli far right, as his nominee for ambassador to Israel, elevating a campaign advisor who had questioned the need for any two-state solution and has likened left-leaning Jews in America to the Jews who aided the Nazis in the Holocaust.
The Jews who aided the Nazis in the Holocaust? What, like the Zionist Jews that did deals with Hitler, as Ken Livingston pointed out, and then was jumped on? And incidentally, this anti-Semitism definition that we're going to bring into British law, does that mean that you can't question anything about the state of Israel? Is that what anti-Semitism means? Because that ain't any sound anti-Semitism in my
mind. Well, that's what the chief rabbi, Ephraim Mervis, was saying a couple of weeks ago. Also, another appointment, Rex Tillerson, the wildcard diplomat. He's the chief of ExxonMobil. He's quite friendly with the Russian energy company, Rosneft, etc., and with Putin, the chief executive of Exxon, to take over as Secretary of State, over from John Kerry.
Well, I mean, Trump looks like he's going to be a disaster, and I think that what they're making sure is that he's not going to be allowed to make peace with Russia. So he can appoint Tillerson, but, you know, events, dear boy, will derail him if he tries to make peace.
Also, all over the news in France this week has been the Britain and the United States tapping into passengers' phones while they're in Air France jets. Lots of other planes too. But why are the NSA and GCHQ targeting the French particularly?
Well, I don't know. You better ask them.
Well, I can tell you why. It's because they are in major power historically in Syria, and they are really not interested in trying to overthrow Assad, it seems, anymore.
Well, no, I think they've actually led the charge. Marine Le Pen probably would be...
Well, there's a big election coming up too, isn't there?
Yeah.
And they always do that. I mean, down in Greece, I can remember, Vodafone actually was spying on... all the Greek politicians in the run-up to the Greeks joining the Euro. So that was a little bit cheeky of them. Anyway, I hope we managed to cover everything I said we were going to. It was a bit of a lot to cover there in the second hour this week. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock now. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to Martin Foda in the first hour and to Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our show page for your comments and criticisms is thisweek.org.uk. A sister show, Dialects, on at noon on Tuesday. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. We'll be here all over the Christmas break. And a special show next week. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Live from the Sky News Centre.